Hiya, welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. Say hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Unusually, we've got Jeff here as well, because this week's episode is a conversation, I can't remember if we've trailed it yet, but we had a really good chat with Professor Susan Rolfe, the esteemed, what is she?
She's Professor Emeritus of Architecture at Heriot Watt University and a kind of pioneering figure in green building and green architecture in the UK for decades.
And did she build the first solar roof in the UK? Was that one of hers?
She said that.
She's a fabulous polemicist as well. We were drawn to include her on the podcast because I saw an article on LinkedIn in Building Design online.co.uk. It was posted to our channel ages ago and it'll be in the show notes. It was her her clap back to COP28. Net zero buildings by 2050. You've got to be joking. Within which she listed a bunch of reasons why we are in a fairly parlous state. And I wanted to talk to her because it's a really good article. It's really interesting. And she is a figurehead in the industry who previous guests have referenced on the podcast, including Huda El Sharif, when she joined us with Andy Simmons to talk about management of thermal performance in a building or management of thermal comfort. Anyway, we decided to have a chat with her. And she was really good value.
Yeah, she was.
Now, the reason why we're both here to record the intro is Susan's got a bit of beef with Passive House. And as the editor of Passive House Plus magazine, a few things were said that we couldn't let go. They could be perceived to be misleading. Some of them are arguable, some of them are unarguable, or rather unreferenced. So we just wanted to offer a few caveats up top, and then we'll let you get into the podcast. So first off is, there's a reference to a divorce caused by a wife not being allowed to open the windows of a Passive House.
So I don't know what that specifically is referencing. It's not a story I've ever heard of. There is this trope that does the rounds that you can't open windows in a Passive House. Of course you can. In fact, it's a requirement of the standard. And it felt like that's what Sue was referencing. So
this is something we'll get into. We're going to have her back. We're going to have an open invitation. Like, man, she's brilliant. Just, we're taking issue with a few of the Passive House pointers. Like, you know, she drew issue to overheating issues within Passive Houses, which is, as Jeff would have it, rarely an issue. But we didn't really define what overheating meant in that context. Not precisely enough, to be fair.
There's one comment she makes where she talks about the first Passive Houses, again, overheating horribly, or I can't remember the exact words. That's just not the case. I mean, the first one was subject to an awful lot of monitoring studies early on, and including during heat waves, and performed very well. We have been writing about Passive Houses for more than a decade now, and many before that, in fact, when the magazine was called Construct Ireland. And in terms of what I think Sue would consider to be overheating, we're just not hearing of problems. You get some buildings that can get into above 25 degree kind of range and into the high 20s. If they're not certified Passive Houses in particular, there can be issues there. But again, you know, when I picked that up in terms of specifics, any building that was in the mid to high 20s, she was saying, well, in a European context, that's a delicious temperature. So I think she's talking about much higher temperatures and we are just not seeing them. I mean,
well, her issue there was that temperatures are on the rise across Europe and these issues are going to hit us. Yeah. In Northern Europe, in a similar manner to the way they are in the Global South, where we could have done better is by defining our terms better, which is why we will have her back to talk in the future with a bit more clarity. Yeah. I mean, regardless, it's an awful lot of fun. So we will all need to make sure we are clearer in our subject matter. Sorry to be so fucking boring. There's another issue about not doing thermal mass well. I think that needs unpicking elsewhere. So we're going to try and have a back to get into what that means. And the same where she critiques Passive House in particular about not doing natural ventilation well.
Yeah. And I mean, I would say natural ventilation doesn't do natural ventilation well is the problem there. I mean, you can naturally ventilate a Passive House, you know, in addition to your mechanical ventilation strategy. manually, you know, opening windows and so on, and cross ventilation and purge ventilation are really kind of important features to try and design in wherever you can. Natural ventilation is important. You need either temperature difference to create the buoyancy to move the air, or air movement. And if you have a still, warm summer day, you've neither of those things.
Yeah, we don't need to get into all that now. That is an episode for the future. I mean, broadly, I think we've got plenty more to talk to her about. And she's fair to critique poor application of passive house in building design, because any bad design, you've got to determine what you mean by design, what you mean by bad, and you've got to analyze it using an appropriate set of metrics. We didn't do any of that. Really, what we spoke about in the end was the colonial history of the global north and its influence on the managing of thermal comfort in building design, problems with architectural education, her storied background and familiarity with ancient building techniques. I think ancient's a fair word to use. Man, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And issues with the flaws in thinking solely about decarbonisation of the grid as a panacea for all building problems, or the problems with an over-reliance on technology. And we barely spoke about the actual article at all.
Yeah.
So check it in the show notes, because it's a really good read.
There's a couple of other things that are worth flagging as well. Sue was kind of suggesting that we move back to cavity wall construction, as if the market has generally moved away from it in the UK. I mean, cavity wall is still the dominant form of construction in the UK. And leave aside the embodied carbon issue, I don't think it's been a great success in terms of operational energy performance. I'm just always nervous about little kind of assertions here or there that kind of people could read too much into. The other thing was, there's a reference to Andy Simmons. Dan, at one point you talked about it being difficult to pick on some passive house zealots, at least for their zealotry, because there seems more of a sense of pragmatism coming through, if that's fair to say.
So I made a point about even passive house people are shifting away from passive house zealotry. And Sue references Andy Simmons, head of the ECB, passive house building designer, having learned from an experience of an overheating building.
And I actually raised that with him. Andy says that he did have a problem with overheating in a project, but it was before he came to passive house, and it was passive house that helped him work out to solve the overheating problem.
Anyway, right. So we'll stop bollocking on now. That's going to be a particularly long intro. So in summary, it's really interesting, but there are some things we want to pick up on in the future.
Yeah, and I love having these kinds of discussions. This is, you know, you have to test your ideas out against people who are going to pick holes in them. So I think it's really important to have this kind of a process. But it's also, I'm anal and, you know, pedantic and stuff like that. So I will tend to try and follow up on something and see if I can support it or not, and then end up alienating people. I hope I haven't done that with Sue. You know, yeah.
Right. So. Apologies for such a pedantic intro. Hope you enjoy the episode. She's a lot of fun. All right. Thank you for listening. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. We don't need to do that.
I don't need to do that. No.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Well, basic common courtesy. I like to kind of try and get that stuff right, you know, having been called all sorts. There's one green architect in Ireland who I'd be very friendly with, who has forever called me Jeff Cooley. And my name's Collie. And I don't understand. It's just some people have these blind spots, I suppose, you know?
No. I think it's like I'm dyslexic and I'll read words. I mean, I cannot write could, should, or would. The D always becomes before the L. So maybe I've got one of those things that transposes letters.
Perhaps, yeah. I think it only happens with me.
Maybe there's a reason for that.
Yeah, perhaps.
Listen,
yeah.
I see you've got your, your whatchamajig blue microphone. I've got one of those.
Oh, yeah, the blue Yeti yoke. Yeah. If it's not too much of an inconvenience, well, only if it's inconvenient, yeah? No, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
It depends on what you say, Sue.
You want me to tone out if I say anything?
I know, no.
So, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. Loud and clear.
Hmm?
Yeah. I was just going through the email exchange we had in the lead up to this, and I've never received as many notes from a guest about what they think they should talk about, we should be talking about. Like, you reframed a bunch of the stuff that I presented, like, rather than talking about a clash between approaches, let's talk about what needs to be done. And
well, I've got a row of books I've written. 1992, Energy Efficient Buildings. 2004, Sustainable Building Benchmark. You know, there's EcoHouse Design Guide, Adapting Buildings and Cities for Climate Change. Last year, we had Resilient Comfort. So I've thought about it a lot, which is why I know there's so much fluff around the edge. But what matters at heart is really significant. And this is why, I mean, what I can't understand, it's a bit like the post office. We've been led down a rabbit hole, for instance, by the air conditioning industry, who tells you comfort can only exist in a certain, you know, narrow band. But we know comfort is a behavioral and cultural construct. You know, you design cultural pathways through the thermal landscapes of your life. It's rather poetic, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that is within certain bounds. There are conditions which are fundamentally uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there are also a lot of constraints on stopping you being comfortable. For instance, you go to work and the lady next to you likes the very thin lady next to you wearing a lightweight summer dress, insists on having the temperature very cold, warm in the building, you know, or your wife who doesn't pay the bills, insists that, you know, you've got to have the house much warmer or vice versa. Because she doesn't pay the bills, you know, I say, make whoever it is, husband or wife, pay the bills. And then they might think differently about what temperature they want to work.
Also, you can't, it's hard to, I mean, generalizations have limits as well. You know, my wife, for instance, likes our place colder than I do.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't lean on that regressive framing so much. Like my missus, she's the big earner in this household and she likes it warm. More than me. I'm the bloody miser.
She pays the bill.
It's a bit more equitable. It's heavier on the luxury.
I mean, what I'm saying is that a constraint is how much you earn and who controls the controls. They're both constraints. Yeah.
And I think there's something in that, like the economic and gender politics aside. Actually, no, gender politics forefront. If you think about the office environment and the way temperatures are managed in them, the eternal battle of the sexes over the office thermostat, whether it's real or not. I mean, I've tended to be in offices where no one had any choice over the thermostat.
Yeah.
Or the thermostat didn't work.
Yeah.
They're deeply unhappy.
Yeah.
Control is important. People have to have a feeling of a sense of control. And it's just the conceptually, the idea of being in a space that you have no control over is going to lead to good outcomes.
Before we lose ourselves in the reeds here, just for the sake of the recording. So today we're here with...
We're now starting blog speak.
Yeah. Podcast rather than blog. But shall we go back to the beginning? So Susan, like the reason why we're talking today is because of that article that was doing the rounds that we reposted into the Zero Ambitions feed. Top 28, net zero buildings by 2050. You have got to be joking. An article where you listed out why so much of current UK policy and international policy is a load of old shite in terms of addressing the problems being inflicted on us by climate change. I wasn't aware of you until then. I know Jeff.
No, you should have been if you've been listening to our podcast, Stan, because Huda had talked about you. So we had a few weeks
ago. Huda Al-Sharif.
Yeah, a couple of months ago, we had Huda Al-Sharif and Andy Simmons, who've been working together. Andy, I'm sure you know Andy as well, the CEO of the AECB, on trying to find a way to enable specific countries they've been working in. Andy says Tanzania rather than Tanzania. That was news to me. Where they've been trying to, rather than use this kind of typical colonial approach, neocolonial, but you know, attempting to be virtuous, kind of probably Bob Geldof style, we'll come in and the white man will come in and save the day with our Western solutions. They're trying to find a way to learn from apply the knowledge that they've gained in a culturally responsible way and take account of local supply chains and the way people use buildings to develop comfortable low energy buildings that would work for local people and that might have a chance of success. And Huda spoke glowingly about you in the context of thinking around understanding comfort and how that works in those kinds of contexts, for instance, how you're finding people able to accept conditions outside of what might be considered the normal boundaries based on what they're accustomed to, you know, physiologically and socially and so on, you know, which is fascinating.
In the next book, which we hope to get out by Christmas, I've got a whole chapter on comfort colonialism. And it's absolutely frightening, because at the beginning of the 20th century, you had people like Elizabeth Huntington who were promoting ideas about the importance of American technology, specifically air conditioning technology, in basically exploiting the resources of the third world. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, you know, these stupid natives, if we white men go over there, we degenerate to being as ignorant and lazy as they are. And what we need is the miracle of air conditioning. So, I mean, basically, that was the premise. And we were doing this in the UK. And there was a UK MP who in 1953 was elected. But before the war, he was a great advocate of Nazism. And he wrote a book, Climate and the Energy of Nations. And he was just saying, you know, come on, if we're going to successfully exploit the hot countries, we need to take air conditioning with us. And we have had the rollout of American air conditioning comfort zones, you know, between 20 and 26, say, and they are in the regulations of India, of Africa, you know, China, of Asia, and they're completely inappropriate because people live in very different temperatures.
Well, this is it. When you look at Huda talked about the fact that you'll have in different parts of say even the Middle East, for instance, you'll find very different responses from a comfort perspective based on what the I suppose the common approaches to buildings and to comfort are, and she was specifically talking about, you know, for instance, I think Saudi Arabia and Dubai and so on, where they try to keep everybody, you know, where people who can afford it are indoors in very cold environments, air conditioned environments, or in an air conditioned car, and never really outside. And their ability to take different temperatures is lesser because they're not accustomed to it. And it reminded me, I was talking to one of the Green Party leader, Eamon Ryan in Ireland, one of his special policy advisors last week. And he just was talking about being a COP28 and going from, you know, a too cold air conditioned room, walking outside to get to another building and the discomfort of, you know, freezing and then sweating and then the water on your back almost freezing when you're in the next room. It's just very poorly conceived, you know.
Yeah, but it's also incredibly short-sighted because they have designed a system that is already failing and will increasingly catastrophically fail. Because, for instance, in Sharjah in August, the grid went down across the whole of the city. And if you're in a glass tower, you can't even open a window, and it's 48 outside, you've got about half an hour to get out of those buildings. Mm. And they poured out onto the streets, but it was 48 outside. Mm. And there's one person on the 26th floor who's disabled. All the lifts don't work. What do? You leave them to bake. I mean, they have created a nightmare in some of these. And I think... And a number of people around the world sort of increasingly agreeing with me that we will see the abandonment of certain building types because they're simply dangerous in more extremes. And, you know, you think, oh, it's over there in the Gulf. But actually, in July 2022 in London, in St. Thomas's and Guy's Hospital, it got to 38 outside in London, and the air conditioning for the server rooms failed. Those two hospitals had 2 days with no computer notes for any of the patients because the increasing temperatures are exceeding the capacity of the machines that were designed to keep them cool. Yeah. So, I mean, it's frightening.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a situation in which a whole swathe of building types, it becomes analogous to the dog in it trapped in a hot car.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, and that's, it's fine when it's happening in the global south, to your point about colonialism, but oh man, Jesus. Like, we've been so misled about how climate change is likely to affect us.
Look, a lot of the modern design trends in architecture in Britain are pushing to increasing overheating of buildings.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who says that the answer is simply putting more insulation around and high U-value glazing and getting rid of the coal bridges and what else? Getting rid of the drafts, technically, and then sort of putting in a little machine to wear some air around it. They're creating some of these nightmare buildings a lot of your listeners will be living in. Modern flats and stuff, patio doors. If you're really lucky, you've got a balcony, you can open it. But no really good opening windows, no cross ventilation.
Yeah.
Overheating distress. I know lots of people who really, I mean, it's virtually, you know, criminal. It's because we're not taking seriously the challenge of climate. And I think it's largely because of another book we wrote or another conference I ran on the education of architects, because architecture went from being taught in the offices where they learned from the experience of the last building, into being taught in 1958 at the first Oxford conference on architectural education, to being taught in universities where they're all overwhelmed by the Bauhaus and, you know, lightweight concrete steel building.
Oil age architecture, I like to call it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But then you've got all the teachers who basically weren't working in offices and got more and more abstruse on history and theory and yada, 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 and didn't realize that what the people in their studios were building was increasingly thermal nightmares. And so a lot of kids have left architecture school not knowing how buildings work.
Yeah.
And so it's a fundamental thing. They got rid of the building science courses and all of that and put in more yada yada. 50% of all the marks go for the studio. And I was on the R board for a number of years, tried to change it, but no, this is exactly what the system wants. We are held back by the inertia in the business as usual status quo system. Like building regulations.
Yeah, the desire for overconsumption. It's interesting, I'd not heard anything as explicit as the situation you described at the start about the technology being developed to fulfill the exploitation of the colonies.
Yeah.
Like, I knew it was a consequence. I mean, any of the problems in any of the broader social problems or technical problems that we've got, you can usually trace back to my missus. She describes it as the holy trinity of things I'm banned from talking about. You ask the question, the problem always goes back to either capitalism, colonialism, imperialism, and the three things are always linked because it's a perpetuation of a system that has driven this sense of overconsumption. The system evolves to generate the profits as conditions change, but not that much. It's still broadly the same thing. I mean, we're seeing it now with the birth of AI. Right.
And your point there is what?
It is a thing that does not do the job it's supposed to do, but it encourages overconsumption. It generates profits for, well, those who benefit.
Okay, I tell you what. This is a really good. I mean, sort of the idea of, you know, are machines more intelligent than people? One of the problems we have is we are all limited by our own life experiences and understandings. And there's this brilliant lady from Arabs at we had a design for the future forum. And she was asked, you know, what's the one thing you would say to architects who want to design better for the future? And she said, go and live in a very hot country. Because you see, you cannot understand what's beyond your limits until you move across them and look back. So your mindset will always be in about thermal comfort, will always be involved in those experience you've had in your lifetime, right? And this is one problem we really don't understand anything out with our own, which is why I and a lot of our friends now, we're moving into the study of thermal comfort in extreme environments. And I spent many years in very hot places, and I'm off next week to Antarctica to look again for the third time at comfort in extremely cold places and learn from that.
Do you not think that one of the things that the industry has been historically terrible at, and that could be a fantastic way to enable us to come up with appropriate solutions, is just to for instance, do post-occupancy evaluation of buildings and, mm-hmm. and actually try and understand as objectively as we can what's working and what isn't, and trying to deduce why.
You know, the conclusion of my first book on adapting buildings and cities for climate change, and it's a really good book, but it was the conclusion. I never know what I'm going to conclude till I've gone through the book and learned from my thing, was that we will never get better buildings in Britain until we change the liability laws. Because you cannot, in the press, criticize a Foster's or a Rogers building or something. I once did it in a forum where they were deciding at Oxford University whether to choose a Richard Rogers glass, all glass building for a laboratory. And I wrote a report and said, this is absolute, you simply cannot do this. This is a nightmare, you know, from all points of view, privacy, comfort, energy use, et cetera. And I got a letter on my desk next week from him himself saying, you know, you cannot do this. You know, I will have you. So, you know, you so threatening.
Yeah.
And this, and you cannot in the press, because you see, they're rich. And they're in The Guardian this week, they had last week, they had articles on this, the liability laws. It's you're getting private prosecutions. You're getting the rich people, like the post office, prosecute, who've got lots of money for lawyers, prosecuting the small people. And so small people like me, get the shit kicked out of us if we step out of line.
Yeah.
And so liability laws, you've got to change.
We've run into that. I mean, we have to be careful as a publisher in this space over time. But we've been able to push things a little bit. I mean, so long as you're... as you're factual and you've got, I'll give you some examples. Well, there's a few examples. So at the moment, there's a case, because there are wealthy, well-heeled apartment owners who are unhappy. There's an apartment building in Ball's Bridge in an affluent part of Dublin. A development by a guy called, a well-known developer called Joe O'Reilly. And I think pretty glassy apartments and well-heeled owners, including, I believe, Rod Stewart, who are pursuing it legally. So obviously, when you're looking
at... What are they pursuing?
The overheating, the discomfort from the fact that the apartments are overheating. And I think when you have a case like this where it's very rare from my experience for a complaint like this, even where it does go legal, for it to actually go to court. Consequently... You know, if there's a settlement, because it's usually in no one's interest, because, you know, the owners of the apartments, they're risking devaluing their investments. So it's not in their interest, ultimately, for you know, they just want the problem fixed, right? So that's the kind of age-old problem. So the temptation is to kind of keep praise specific and criticism generic for that reason, but you do occasionally find examples where people are brave enough to come forward, even where developers are.
I've got a fabulous example of that, and this is what this. But it's in America, and I had to really, really dig for this one, because the lawyers involved cannot publish anything out with the settlement, and it was a single really brilliant lawyer in the Bay Area in San Francisco. They had a condominium of three big buildings all overglazed and supposed to be naturally ventilated, and designed by SOM. Esso eventually, after 5 years of litigation, SOM had to pay out millions to the occupants of that one, right? So it's happened in America. And I mean, the downside is, what do they do about it? And what do the occupant, I mean, what's the settlement going to be? I mean, in the case of SOM, it was millions. It has been done. But it's like flooding too. Something like 50% of all councils in England still allow housing on floodplains. They're doing it in Lewis now.
Bananas. That's astonishing. Yeah.
Absolutely bananas. Yeah.
Oh, we're going to build the bank a bit higher. That will not work in super floods, you know. So, but why do people buy? And it's like Manchester now. Manchester City Corporation is so, and Glasgow as well, they're doing all these big glass towers. Glass, all the walls are glass. You can't even open a window. I mean, why would anybody buy anything like that? Because it's going to fail. I mean, the lights will go out in these storms that are coming.
You know, Sue, for me, and I don't want to be glib, but whenever I think of these kinds of things, I've got Michael Gove's words from the Brexit campaign ringing in my ears that, you know, we've had it with experts. And I think there's a bit of that. And I think, you know, people's attention spans are not where they should be.
I think you're misdiagnosing. Like, the experts are running the show. They know how to make the money. They don't beg the consequences because, as Sue's pointed out, there are none. Then people that make that money, and that is it. Done, gone. They're away. We currently have a system of carpet bagging. Like, the point of Manchester is really interesting because, like, the Manchester skyline changed so much with the influx of Abu Dhabi's wealth. The Manchester City owners, they came in and they were granted very favourable terms for knocking up buildings. Just fill it, pack it out. And they'll knock them out, and then, well, there's no liability. They've made their money, they move on. The cost, the price of housing in Manchester's gone berserk.
Well, it's falling now.
Is it?
Yeah. My son's just bought a house there.
All right. Where's he moved to?
Levenshulme.
So the one of the formerly less salubrious areas.
Up and coming.
Well, yeah, isn't everywhere nowadays.
Yeah.
Right. So just half an hour in, I think we'd better let you introduce yourself, Sue. So anyone who's unfamiliar with who you are, do you want to give us a bit of background on where you come from and how... Okay. The sort of authority you've come to be.
Okay. I'm Sue Roche. I am Emeritus Professor of Architectural Engineering at Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh, a brilliant school which combines architecture and engineering. But I have been lucky. I mean, the reason why I am different is because I was born in Malaya, lived there till I was 5. That's tropical climate. Then I went out and lived in the bush in Australia from 5 till 11. Then I was sent to English boarding school. And then when I went to Manchester University and did 4 years of architecture. But then I went to the Middle East and in Iran. And while I was there working on architectural digs, I saw these amazing systems whereby you can make ice in the desert. You've got these wind towers, which are natural coolers, and et cetera, et cetera. So eventually my doctorate ended up on the wind towers while I was at the AA for my second degree. And then I also lived for a while on two long migrations with nomads in the mountains of southwestern Iran. And then there happened to be a passing archaeologist. So I ended up with Agatha Christie's job, as the wife of the head of the British School of Archaeology in Iraq, and spent 7 years in the remote Iraqi villages excavating buildings over, you know, like thousands of years from sort of 6,000 BC to the present. So it gave you a different sense of time. So you understood buildings and that the thing. And then I came back to Britain and everybody was building all these, you know, stupid buildings and stuff like that that were driving climate change. And my nomads who live between the desert and the zone, they sort of occupy that space on their migrations. they were all their springs on the migration routes were drying up. So they had nothing. They used dry dung to heat their tea, you know, they used nothing. And they were the first victims. And I thought, this isn't fair. So I built my eco house in Oxford, which is very famous because it's the first solar roof in Britain. So in a sense, I think because I've come from the past, the deep past, I sort of feel like an ambassador of the future, that I can see climates you can't see because I've lived in them and experienced them and conditions. So in a way, it's like being a backcaster, somebody who, you know, dwells in the future and projects forward, because I can see things you can't see. It's like my favorite film, Blade Runner. You know, I've seen things you would not believe, ships on fire on the shores of Orion, all that stuff. And so I perhaps speak with a different mindset, which is why I think I've done 23 books now. I mean, written and edited them, right from books in 1992, The Ice Houses of Britain. I wrote that classic book. And then Energy Efficient Buildings in the early 1990s, which is basically passive house theory. Then the noughties, we get on to sustainability. And let's face it, nobody knows what sustainability is, do they? So I wrote a book on benchmarks for sustainable buildings. And then I wrote Eco House Design, how to design buildings that will keep you safe in extremely hot climates, because I'd learned those lessons from Iran and Iraq. And then adapting buildings and cities for climate change, looking at why we're where we are, where we're going, and basically how we're being held back by the status quo. And as I said, the conclusion of the first book was that unless we get changes to the liability laws, and that people can't bring private prosecutions on people who say, that's a crap building. Yeah, you can't publish in the press and say that's a crap building, because you get the lawyer's letter, and it's all the small people. There's lots of architectural, this is why you get such bland architectural criticism in the press, because you don't want to be sued. But the conclusion of the second edition of that book was that there is nothing that's going to keep you safe in an extreme weather event. The grid goes down, your house is flooded, there is no heat, you're stuck in a super insulated box with no thermal mass and no heating. The only thing that will keep you safe is being in a strong community. So you can go to the neighbor next door or the neighbor around the corner. So why are they selling off the playing fields, selling off the community halls, selling off the libraries? You know, those community spaces are going to be our salvation in extreme climates in the future. I end my lesson for today.
So, like the way we sort of framed the conversation when we were chatting over email was, we were going to talk about one of the things we were going to talk about was the article that you wrote and the need for resilience in buildings. But you're actually talking beyond just resilience in the buildings towards resilience in the communities, which is a curious framing for our trade, hey Jeff. We normally just think about the bricks and mortar.
Well, yeah, I'm probably guilty of that to a certain extent. But I understand what you're saying, and I think there's an awful lot of truth in what you're saying too. It's also, you know, there's this kind of libertarian fantasy some people have of the energy independent building, and I wonder how useful it is to think like a survivalist. You know, it's not probably. Nick Brand talks about this in the context of while PV is really important. The example he was making was that, Take the health service. You have a national health service in the UK. It's more beneficial to think of it as an overall system that everyone contributes to. It doesn't mean in the context of PV, it doesn't mean you can't have PV on your buildings, but you're not trying to act like an island, you know.
But listen, so taking a very limited standpoint is sort of because, I mean, in my evolving mantra, what matters is buildings first, right? So you have to get the building right. When the lights go out, when you get an extreme snowstorm or an extreme heat wave and the grid goes down, you're not going to be saved by a heat recirculation system or, you know, any sort of machines. You're not going to be saved by the grid. What's going to keep you thermally safe is that building. So you have to get the building right.
Yeah.
Now, the second thing is, and you say, oh, survivalist. I mean, I see, Jeff, 10 years, right? Everybody should have as much of their building run. The buildings of the future will be like this, right? They will have to be run for as much of the year as possible on local natural energy. The government now is putting all their money into decarbonization of the grid because, and they've forgotten buildings, you know. Yeah. But actually, buildings will become the sort of the mainstay of the resilient future. So, you know, I can quite easily see, like, my house, the first solar roof, 1995, getting on for 30 years old. And if you look at how much energy I use, like my gas and electric bills with outstanding charges and everything was for all of those, it was £483 for a six-bedroom house, a really comfortable house, right? Because quite a lot of the work in this building is done by the solar roof, but that's only part of it. Solar roof is only part of the whole. Now, you're talking about the national health system. If only they had built, put solar on all of the hospitals and taken all of the hospital estates, you're much better working at a community level. You take all the hospital estates and you put as much solar on as you can, as much thermal inertia to, like, thermal mass to slow down the temperature spikes, which is where you need the air conditioning.
Sure.
And as much natural ventilation as possible. And then I once said to a bloke who was really rich, a sort of billionaire in Croatia, I said, what we really need is solar mortuaries, right? Because the last thing you want in an extreme heat wave like 2003 in Paris is lots of dead bodies piling up on the streets. Mm. You need to, when the grid goes down, you need to be able to keep them cold.
Yeah.
So, what we need is solar mortuaries in every hospital. So you dig them down into the ground like an ice house, and you have a big thermal battery in the structure, and you have thermal batteries and electric batteries to back them up, and you run them all on solar. So even in an extreme heat wave, they can keep the bodies cold. Anyway, stat me vittles. If 3 years later, another friend of mine, Maria Todorovic in Slovenia, she says, oh, he got me to design a solar mortuary, and she built one. We need, and you could use that for thermal inertia for a hospital estate too. So you get a super air conditioning spike, and then you just draw energy in from that solar, that slow battery, which is the slow solar mortuary.
So moving away from what could be framed as the pragmatic, like thinking about resilience in terms of the practical, because we have, all right, so just thinking about Western Europe currently, we have a climate that's going to be changing. We have an education system for architects and building designers that's limited. We have a system in which the infrastructure is not geared up to deliver what we need, to appreciate what we are going to need. Funding models don't support the sort of change that's required. Most of the building stock that's going to exist in 2050 has already been built anyway. What they're knocking up is a load of old shite in the meantime. So how do we address resilience?
Okay.
Because
let's face it, we live in an ever more divided world. And everybody says, oh, the rich blokes can afford air conditioning. It's the rich blokes that are the stupid ones at the top in the penthouse in the all glass building. And like a mate of mine in Edinburgh, they had a power outage in Edinburgh. And he had this super sexy penthouse with all the sexy lights and doors and everything, sang and danced and whistled, you know, according to his remote control. They had a blackout. He couldn't even get out of his living room because it was an electric door. They couldn't afford flats. I mean, these people stuck up in their glass towers, not even ivory. So they're the ones who are going to, I mean, especially if you're disabled, you die first.
Yeah, but, well, an ivory tower would at least reflect some of the heat.
Now, listen, I think a really good thing is that I'm interested in the ordinary woman on the street and the man on the street, or the they on the street. And you have to take it into your own hands. If you've got overheating, west-facing windows,
get
yourself an awning. If you've got windows that don't open, or this stupid stuff, which is like you can only open it about 10 centimeters, which is ridiculous. You can't get cooling. The air conditioning industry's done that. So you have to resort to the machine. But change your windows. Get good sash windows with a security grill. So, you know, the kids can't fall out. Look after yourself. Make sure you can get some natural ventilation. Put the Velux in the roof over the stairs.
Yeah.
So you can get good air, cross ventilation and airflow through.
You know, you see that too in a lot of, I mean, there's sometimes a dichotomy painted between, say, passive house and some of these principles, but most of the passive house projects that we write about have those kinds of strategies built in. Most of them have quite sober glazing ratios. And it's very common to rely on either cross ventilation or night purge ventilation in the summer, for instance, to enable you to maintain decent comfort.
Yeah, but come on, that's not how they start. Oh my God, no. Ugh. Some of those mantras are terrible and they stick around, you know. I think it's one of his aide-de-camps of Wolfgang Feist in the 90s threatened divorce. Because he wouldn't let his wife open the window. Good German Hausfrau. To throw the bedding out every morning, you know. Because
Did he say that?
Hmm?
No,
I heard somebody who was working with him at the time said, my wife.
Yeah, he's insistent that, I mean, one of the requirements of the passive house standard is that you have to be, I think there's very few exceptions, but you have to be able to open windows in virtually every room. Feist has said himself.
Well, they say that now because some of the early ones overheated. That first one overheated so badly. But the other thing is, I heard yesterday on Sunday it was, a mate of mine dropped in and his daughter is designing a passive house. She's got an architect in Scotland designing a passive house. And I said, oh, what heating are they putting in? And he says, oh, they don't need heating. Because it's a passive house, I said. What planet are you on, mate?
Yeah.
I
would never advise it. I'd never advise it, but you do see some people that do that. When we were, before we rebranded as Passive House Plus, when some of the early Passive House projects were happening in Ireland in the mid to late noughties, you'd see some people, it was becoming quite common for people to put like a stove in. And maybe like a towel rail in the bathroom. And in some cases, we actually ran an article on this because there was an intersection between that and the economy collapsing. So you got a lot of self-builders building houses where, you know, there were a few cases we ran into where people had plumbed in underfloor heating and then run out of money. So not connected to anything, for instance. And what you find, a lot of the ones with stoves, the story that was coming through is people were, they ended up being ornamental. Basically, it depends on the house. And I would never advocate people to.
That's buildings first, right? You've got to get the design right. It's the buildings first thing. You have to get the design right because, I mean, passive house will work in a well designed house, right? It won't work in a badly designed house.
I mean, the same could be said of everything, though. Like, bad design causes things to break. Or be broken.
Exactly.
Well, we've seen enough failing kind of attempts at passive solar houses, you know, as well in the past. I've talked about it in the past on the podcast before, even on non-domestic buildings. There's one, Sue, that we wrote. I'll share it with you after. It was an article we wrote in an office building in Ireland years ago. And we would do, we were always a bit different from most of the architectural magazines in that we would not just talk to the architect. We'd get their spiel on how wonderful and virtuous the building's meant to be. And then we'd talk to either builder or we'd talk to the facilities manager or the occupants or whatever, right? And get their story. And that often added another dimension. And there's one we published, which was a deep plan office building with an atrium and stack ventilation. Stack ventilation can be very effective, but in this case, they had no mechanical at all, and a lot of south, it was a south or southwest facing glass, I can't recall. But we spoke to the architect, gave us his spiel. We spoke to the facility manager, and he and asked how it was going, and said, actually, we're getting lots of complaints about discomfort. And we went back to the architect, and he got very angry. And he said, it's a sustainable building. It's not supposed to be comfortable. We managed to keep a lot of that in the article. Not quite that.
Yeah, but you know, honestly, let's look at, it's basically we're talking about good design.
I mean, exactly.
We're not talking about a product like Passive House. And one of my other objections to Passive House is that it's leading to so many, you know, flaws, which, for instance, it doesn't deal with volume. So you get all these, the modern fashion for, which is really difficult for the barn-like houses, you know, oh, it looks like a rural barn. So you've got a V-shape, you know, you've got a hitch roof over a big space, kitchen at one end, dining room, at the other end, huge spaces to heat. All the heat, any hot air is piling up underneath the roof. And they're really a bit of a thermal nightmare. But it doesn't come up because it, you know, Passive House doesn't deal with that third dimension. So, I mean, let's forget that product, but let's talk about, you know, good design or bad design or what people should be doing. You know, it's like one of our ex-students at Oxford Brookes, Charlie Luxton.
Oh, yeah.
He's saying, you know, open plan was fine in the 20th century. We've got to go to broken plan. What we have to do is talk about the thermal landscaping of buildings. You know, it's hot at the top of the house in a heat wave. It's cold in the north-facing rooms. It's hot in the south-facing rooms. So comfort is the result of the interaction of the occupants and the thermal landscapes in the building. So they will learn how to harvest heat when they need it or cold when they need it. So, I mean, let's talk about the thermal landscaping of buildings. Let's have a climate refuge for summer, spacing rooms. Let's have a warm room for like this room now with the sun pouring in into my study. So, I mean, to start to work with nature around the building, you know, because a building's not a cardboard box with a machine in it. Yeah. It is part of an ecosystem, and that climate's part of that ecosystem.
Yeah, I agree with that. A lot of the, and we featured some of Charlie's work in the mag actually.
But and he's been a guest on the podcast.
Yeah, his studios, his own architectural studios, which is it's an uncertified passive house with some of the kind of principle that you're talking about built into it as well.
Yeah,
I think the thing is that we're most of the people that we engage with in the mag and podcast too are thoughtful about buildings, and they're happy to kind of ask. Not evangelical, happy to ask kind of difficult questions to understand. And even with, so like Passive House does have some areas where more work is needed. Passive House Trust, for instance, produced a summer comfort document. I don't know if you saw it. Which referenced the fact that in larger buildings, and this is a principle that I think is very useful for people to take account of, the overheating assumptions in Passive House are really not in the Passive software, PHPP, are really not sufficient. So if you've like an apartment building, having an average result overall in terms of overheating is not going to be helpful to people who are on the southwest facing apartment.
No.
We've seen it with some larger, and we try not to publish overly large passive houses because an overly large passive house isn't a sustainable building at all. Where you have like a particular bedroom that might be problematic, you know.
Yeah.
But by and large, and there's a project actually that we're working on, which I need to find a way to actually resuscitate it with Bill Bordas and Adrian Lehman, where we've been going back over 10 buildings that we've profiled in at least 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, using their building use studies methodology. And Bill and Adrian, as I'm sure you know, are two people who've become by their own admission, pariah figures in the industry for asking the uncomfortable questions, you know, and daring to kind of try and talk about it, you know. But that's exactly what's needed, that kind of warts and all exposition of everything.
Is Passive House I mean, does it have the liability problem where a designer can say, this house has got extreme overheating problems, but I use passive house?
They're not happening. Honestly, things, you know, they're not happening. You get a little bit. There's a study that Shane Coakley, who's an academic, former chairman of the Passive House Association, worth just disclosing that. But he's an academic, Dr. Shane Coakley, at University College Dublin and the University of Ulster. And he's just completed a study on overheating in passive houses and other low energy buildings in Ireland. And when you look at the results for the, I think it's sort of 30, 40 dwellings or so in the study, from some schemes and some individual homes and so on. And when you look at the results overall, they're more or less, they're all there or thereabouts. And I think the vast majority were meeting the less than 10% of the year over 25 degrees required by passive house.
Can I just say here?
Yeah.
And I gave a lecture with, next to the chief scientist of the passive house movement in Paris, where I was with Fergus Nicol.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, the idea that some people ought to get out more, because PHP thinks that because it's a North German colder climate, it thinks that anything above 26.
It's not, though. You can change the climate.
But that's what they were saying. And they were saying that comfort does not work.
Yeah.
And we thought, oh, God, what? You ought to get out more, mate.
Well,
because, I mean, 26 is perfectly, deliciously comfortable, or 27, 28 in the Mediterranean in the summer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, that's it. I mean, you know, they're not, there are some cases with some passive houses where I know of one that we're going to be publishing in this annual, or one of the bedrooms was getting into the high 20s, I think maybe even 30 degrees at times. And the reason was that the design included for a shed externally, which would be providing some shading. And for whatever reason, the homeowners decided not to put it in. You'll get that too with some passive houses where, and I think it's a question I need to look into whether we've seen it with certified passive houses, because technically they shouldn't be being certified unless people have provided the shading that they're meant to be. I think I'm not sure if there's been cases with certified passive houses where that's been occurring. But no, I agree with you. I mean, you know.
Okay. Should we move on from passive house and say, right, fine. Passive house principles, like I say, sort of the basic 1990s thinking, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't do thermal mass well, doesn't do natural ventilation well, doesn't do volume well, stuff like that. But that's irrelevant. It's a jolly useful tool.
I would disagree with you on some of those points.
Well, before we move on, like, I would like to, and we can go to your point if it is appetite to do so, like, feel free to interrupt me back. But the critiques that you're leveling at Passive House and PHPP in particular are of poor application of the principles, bad design. This is more about how the designers are educated and use their education and the fundamentals of the spreadsheet. Because I thought something you said in the chat with us, that the building design has been captured by the engineers, and the lazy-brained building people who are delighted that a spreadsheet will now do their jobs for them.
Yeah.
But passive house as a design system, it does have its limitations.
Of course.
Okay.
Like anything does.
Yeah.
But the limitation is, I mean, as you alluded to earlier, it's all in the heads of the people who are doing the actors in any given.
Yep. Can I say that I think fundamentally the problem is one that was identified. Do you know Sydney Smith was the wittiest Englishman ever to have lived in the 1780s or 90s, and he had very many bon mots, but he was walking along with a friend in the old city in the late 18th century, old city of London, and there are these corbelled houses, and one fishwife was in the top floor talking to a fishwife, screaming at her, throwing the slops out at the other fishwife, and they were having a real barney. And he turned to his friends and he said, "You see, those ladies will never agree. Do you know why? Because they're talking from different premises." Okay.
Yeah.
Premise being a building or an.
Oh, gosh.
They're talking from different premises. Oh,
intellectual cracker jokes.
Yeah. It's the problem is that we need to change the premises. Number one, for instance, we need to say, how do we design buildings with internal climate refuges so they don't overheat in summer, don't overcool, right? So that's a different, how do we design for more extreme climates in the future? That's a change of premise, not to be more efficient buildings, but fit for purpose in a more extreme climate. The second premise now is, how do we design pandemic ready homes? I mean, how do you get a home that you can have different bedrooms where people can isolate and you know, open the window and lead naturally ventilated lives? So they ought to be pandemic proof as well, shouldn't they? We need to develop premises that are future facing.
Well, this is actually, you've given me a delightful segue there to something else I wanted to pick up on. Like, you've been very damning of the ventilation industry. I don't understand quite how or why. I understand about the critique, the fundamental critique of air conditioning. Like, we shouldn't be designing because, like, as much as we might reach decarbonisation, you've got to have the electricity to power it. So I think
it's design out beneath for wherever you can. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But like,
it is, we're getting back to that same premise. What is a good building? We like well-designed building for designing for 2030 or 2050. And this is where I say it's the buildings first. The trouble is that the regulations, it's a state capture of the regulations by the HVAC industry. So the regulations are all about providing conditions indoors that require a machine to produce them. So as I say, Bjørn Olesen, who is the successor to Ole Fanger, who developed PMV and PPD, which most of the regulations are based on, like he says, you have to design the buildings of the future will need to run for as much of the year as possible on local natural energy. And only when you need it should you be air conditioning or heating them. So the trouble is with the regulations today, they push you away from designing better buildings. They push you into putting more and more and more equipment in. And so the ordinary developer will say, well, I can't afford X, Y, and Z a proper building because I've got to put all this, you know, heat recirculation and all these ducts and stuff in. So it's the premise is wrong. We need to be designing the better buildings first and then just using heating and cooling when it's needed. And it's, for instance, Martin Lewis. I mean, there's loads. All of us are getting poorer. We are the disappearing middle classes. Our money's less in the pocket and worth less every year. And you have to heat the person, not the building. So there's whole new mixed mode developments where you naturally ventilate as long as possible. Then you keep people warm in their little winter comfort refuge. You know, they'll have the heated, you know, vests or the local heaters or local coolers in the cool area of the house and stuff like that. We have to design for a different type of building in which whole house air conditioning or whole house heating or cooling is a secondary step. You have to get the building right first. So, I mean, the regulations that have been introduced because people get laws through government according to how much they spend on their lobbyists. Yeah. So why is there such huge money going into all these laws forcing people into heat pumps when they could be putting the same money into improving the buildings?
So your critique there of the HVAC industry, the capture, is that is founded in its current dominance. Now, the green building heads and the pedants out there at home will cite the fact that within building regulations, there is always a loophole that enables innovation so long as it meets certain thresholds. But if you're talking about a large-scale developer, they're not really interested in innovation. Or there are few that are interested in innovation. They've got P&L sheets to fill. They've got to make money and fix up the bottom line so the line goes up. So very quickly, the premise isn't necessarily about effectiveness. It's about scalability, because it's only through scalability that you will be able to foster industry-wide adoption. Like, the biggest beast with the biggest purchasing power is going to make or break technology. So that leads us to a question of scalability. How scalable But you're talking about, and I am agreeing with you about the needs for building design in terms of the flexibility of its use into about active management and adaptation of how you use it based on the circumstances you're in. I might be articulating myself quite poorly there, but all the stuff you said about, like, we need to manage the thermal mass of our buildings in terms of things like mitigating passive solar. You know, you use the example of having awnings. We need to use the parts of the building that are appropriate. Now, that's not going to be viable to everyone. You also cited like switching out the windows at the same time. And having priced up changing the windows on my house, like, that's a well dear job. You've referenced like active management of a building's thermal mass, which, I mean, it's a lot harder to do than just heating it. Like, and it's a lot harder to get people to take it seriously. Individualized solutions. We met Jay Stewart last week, who told me about a really fascinating, and in fact, no, I won't go down that rabbit hole. That'll just lead us.
Okay.
So how do we deal with scalability?
Yes, yeah, scalability. Like, I mean, basically, I mean, you're sort of lightweight prefabs, off-site construction that are then knocked up and, you know, left out in the rain and stuff. They designed, I mean, the British cavity wall building was well designed for the climate. So you had your external wind and storm and raincoat on the outside. You had a gap where water would run down in the middle. And then you had the inside, which is the flesh and the body of the building. So, I mean, scalability, they always used to build the cavity wall buildings. I mean, maybe we should be going back to that because obviously the developer can make more money if they're putting up a chipboard mansion than if they're actually building a solid old one. But I want to say that, for instance, you know your window problem. This is something in 2014, I was in Adelaide where they had a super, or as in Australia, super heat wave. And people were dying in their lightweight houses, the elderly, because they just got so hot they couldn't stand it. So I wrote this article on design your gran a cool corner for Christmas, right? So you just make one room thermally safe. And then I did design your gran a cozy corner for her birthday. And you make one room safe. So you do the windows on your one room where you're living in summer for really good natural ventilation. And now they've taken it up with Melbourne. And so in southern Victoria, they are supporting people putting in a cool refuge in each house. So you just do it for the one room. You start with that. You give people a chance.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in a crisis that is and should be defined by its extremes, not the averages, as we were describing earlier, we need to create spaces that will cater to those extremes.
Yeah, keep people safe in otherwise. Buildings. Yeah.
I have to say, I think with new build, we can make, you know, buildings resilient enough certainly in the UK and an Irish context, even taking account of God knows what might happen with the Gulf Stream and so on, you know, and the impact of that. I think we can make buildings, you know, whole buildings pretty resilient and safe. It doesn't mean that you don't have certain parts of it that can't be, you know, cooler, but...
I say that, but Alan Kennedy, who's a brilliant climatologist from Bristol, he gave us a talk in 2022 in April, and he said, listen, I've got some bad news for you. You have to start designing for 40 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
Because somewhere before 2050, somewhere in the UK, it will reach 40 degrees outside. Three months later, it reached 40 degrees outside.
I know.
He gave us another talk in September that same year, and he said, listen, my advice to you is do not believe an optimist. He said we should be designing for 45 degrees now.
Yeah, exactly.
Compared to 2050.
So the likes of Exeter City Council have been taking that lead. They do use passive house standard, but using 2080 extreme climate change scenario climate files. So there's a kind of a robustness built into that, I think. And I would take a lead from the great thing about those kinds of extreme weather events, to the extent that they have been happening, as worrying as they are, is that we are starting to see some of the building anoraks who live in and, you know, and are monitoring these buildings live reporting on the actual conditions and how they're operating them to keep them livable. You know, so for instance, in a passive house, in those situations, it might be that you the approach that people have been adopting is when you have several days of very high temperatures and high nighttime temperatures, is that you shut up the building completely as far as you can during the daytime, and you open it up completely at nighttime. Stuff that you'd be well accustomed to. So you can still.
All very well, except when you have your one living area, kitchen, dining room.
Yeah, fair point. Room,
With a wall of glass facing the view.
Yeah. It's true, and that is a worry for more conventional kind of architecture led glassy design. You know, there needs to be a bit of sobriety. Nick Grant talks about. He suggests we need to be designing buildings the way a kid would draw them, you know, small window, basically.
Well, I say two things, right? Every community, because not everybody is going to be able to, and especially a lot of people in modern flats and houses that are overheating so badly, push comes to shove, and the grid goes down and it's a super heat wave, like happened under the heat dome in Northwest, well, in Vancouver, where it got 248. Mm. We need to have climate refuges in every community. This is where the community comes in. So a hot weather and a cold weather refuge. And the second thing is, some brilliant work's been done on educating school kids about living with heat in Seville. So maybe we ought to be having classes in schools, primary schools. And people say, oh, golly, it's getting hot. What do you do? And they take off their clothes, they open the window. They go to a quieter place, and then they take the lessons home to granddad or grandma or mum and dad at home. You start educating a generation to know what to do.
Well, in terms of retrofit, we know of that being a success from AC White up in Glasgow, who in the work that they've done, so advocate, like sending out retrofit advocates into the communities. Like some of the greatest success they had was going teaching primary school kids.
Yeah.
Who like sponges, soaked it all up, understood it, because they are growing up with an awful lot of these issues around them. They've never known the time before. And not through pester power per se, but through being really powerful evangelists. Yeah.
I say here a final thought from me? Is passive house movement has been hugely important. And if you see it in the context of half a century, right? We took all these young kids coming out of university with very little climate design training, very little understanding about how buildings work. Passive house gave them a system where they could say, I'll get it. You know, I can do this, I can do that. So it's been fantastically important. And the system, you know, as it's applied today, has got its limitations, but that will evolve, right? And so don't get me wrong, I think it's been a fantastically important movement, but I also think we need to, like those fishwives, change our premises.
I think one of the ways it's been most useful, a lot of the people who go through the courses end up it's their gateway into building science, into building physics. So you find, I know a bunch of people a number of architects, for instance, who've ended up doing what you'd best describe as building pathology.
Yeah.
They're trying to understand what is causing buildings to fail, whether it's heat, whether it's moisture, whether it's air quality and so on. And that's been fascinating. And the other thing that's been really heartening too for me is that even though, say, from the certifier perspective, is that even though the standard itself in certain areas may not have particular prescriptions for specific kinds of problems, we've come across cases where the certifier will not certify a building because of problems that they can foresee with it. For instance, around one obvious example that we were approached about was a timber frame building with an external airtight layer, and the fear was that if you take if you take the airtight layer outside the insulation layer, there's a risk that you can't tell when you do your air tightness test whether you've got an intact vapor control layer, and you may have condensation problems interstitially. So, you know, they pursued that, they held onto it doggedly,
And those kinds of insights, I think, are really, really important. And there's this, I think it's that rigor, that quality assurance, and that what we always have to avoid, all of us in all strands of this, is becoming nodding dogs and becoming evangelical. You know, it's exactly. So important to kind of ask yourself continuously the awkward questions and work out whether what you're proposing is, you know, can be improved upon, and you know, and whether it's appropriate in all contexts. You know,
I'm finding it harder to mock passive house people as being zealots at the moment. Certainly the passive house people I come into contact with, I can't make a good faith case for mocking Andy Simmons anymore. I have to insult him in bad faith.
Andy learned very early on about the problems of overheating. So he evolved, you know? So we all have to evolve, don't we? The life experience, passive house has been fabulous in lifting the conversation, you know, changing the understanding. So it just has to evolve. We all have to evolve fast. I think it's that thing, like I say, I'm an ambassador from the future because I've lived in countries where it's 50 degrees.
We're
talking about 45 degrees, then we just have to change, you know, think cogs change in your brain.
Well, if you end up in a situation where we have long stretches of several days in a row of 40 degrees plus, you know, heat. I mean, my wife is Australian. She grew up in South Australia. I think there's a town called Cooper Pedy.
Cooper Pedy. I've been there.
Town. Everybody lives underground, don't they?
It's an old gold town, and they all shower in salty water because that's what the boars produce.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, for instance, I'm going down to Antarctica, and then in April, I'm going, my twin sister's a lorry driver in the Queensland bush.
Right.
And I'm going out with her to Heron Island, which is the most remote resort island on the Great Barrier Reef. And I looked at it 30 years ago. I'm going to see how it's changed in terms of the system to keep one small, limited catchment area, you know, supplied and so on. And then I'm going out with my brother-in-law and sister from Sydney. We're going out to the Pilbara, which is between Perth and Darwin. So we're going out to the Aboriginal communities where Bob's designing an Aboriginal community centre. And I want to spend some time underneath the trees with the old boys and girls and ask them, why do you sit this side of the tree? What's the wind like? How are you dealing with increasing temperatures? And I'll probably go to see Tropo Architects in Darwin and see what the increases in temperature are doing for their, because they naturally ventilate all their buildings. So we have to learn from these extremes. And what I learned in Antarctica studying the Chilean base at Escondida was that a really major factor is carried coal through spaces from people working outside and coming in from lunch. So the idea that you got, you know, conducted, reflected, convectional heat and cold, but you've also got the cold that people carry, which is one of the lessons I learned from the ice houses. You need these airlocks so that people can shed or gain temperature and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's where I'm lucky. I'm learning from the extremes.
Oh, man, that's fascinating.
I know.
I'm really looking forward to hearing about your experiences in the Antarctic. It is the Antarctic you're going to. Yeah.
Antarctic, yeah.
I saw a photo exhibition at the Natural History Museum where a photographer was documenting those environments and how those environments are being affected by the climate crisis. And the thing that has really stuck with me is that some of the buildings, they're becoming fundamentally unsafe. Their foundations are failing because of the warming of the permafrost. So it means that the structure's fundamentally broken.
It's like, for instance, I designed this tent. I designed a tent for a remote site in Collins Glacier, right? So we shipped the tent out, made it here, shipped it out, and then we took it to this remote site by Zodiac and erected the tent based on a Mongolian yurt. And 5 years later, in two major storms in that area, it's still standing, you know, looking pretty good 5 years later. So we're going back to look at that. But when we were designing it, we had to do a lot of development modeling and stuff like that. And the key question was, what direction do you face the door into in an extreme site? I mean, it sounds silly, but we had real arguments because somebody said, well, I said to begin with, well, of course, you face it out of the wind, don't you? Mm. And all the old boys who drove the Zodiac say, no, you're stupid. That's the last place you put it. And I said, well, why? And they said, because that's where the snow gathers. Mm. And you can't face it into the wind. So you have to face it at an angle, you know, which the wind goes past but doesn't go into. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. And here, I presume it's the same in the UK, but I'm in Ireland. The getting planners to move away from requiring front door facing road, whichever direction that might happen to be, is half the battle, you know?
Yeah, I know. The position of that entrance into it can be really important. And the idea that you open it in facing the wind, and then every time you go in, the wind blows. But then that's the other thing, which I did here, is that trouble with temperature, people only see what they can see. So you open the door. So I've got a nice lobby, two or three steps from the lobby to the front door. And you think, I've shut the door, so the cold wind's gone out. So, you know, I can take my coat off and stuff. But the wind falls on that floor. And so it chills the floor. And you can't see creeping chill through the floor. So I thermally break the concrete floor on the outside with the concrete floor on the inside. Simple things like that to stop the pathways and the roots. But anyway, I bore for Britain, so you're going to stop me.
Well, we are going to wrap up now. The pair of you, is there anything we want to touch on? We're at time. It's going to be
I would just say, in defense of lighter weight buildings, and from an embodied carbon perspective, you know, when we've started running the calcs on buildings, you know, we're getting some excellent results with some lighter weight buildings that we are seeing good performance. Looking back at post occupancy data on lightweight buildings, I think we can make them work really well, frankly.
Can I say that something I learned from a scientist in the Negev who is studying the cows of Siberia, that in extremes, there is not one way. So an animal in the Arctic, like a polar bear, will hibernate, okay? So they survive in one way. And a cow develops a lot of brown fat that's still out on the steps. With buildings, there's not only one way. And if you take a Mongolian yurt, which is a lightweight structure, just a couple of things have felt over, and they just have quite light carpet on the floor, and that so they can store heat in the floor.
Yeah.
Thing about that lightweight structure is fine, but you have to have, when it's minus 40 outside or 30, you have to have that hot stove on when you come in from herding the cattle. You have to heat it. You can't have a lightweight structure when it's extremely cold without heat in the middle.
Yeah. So we're back to the point about building design.
Yeah.
It's got to be designed to do the job.
I can think of actual passive houses. Well, they might have had a bit of relatively thermally massive insulation, like, you know, cellulose insulation in some cases or whatever, but I think of timber frame buildings with timber frame passive houses with little or no space heating where the data looks really good. I think that, you know, you're touching on
what's the temperature outside.
I mean, this is in an Irish context where we don't tend to get crazily cold temperatures. But we did one, we featured, when I did my TEDx talk, there was a passive house in Colorado, which was built, timber frame passive house. That was really interesting because, you remember the deep free?
I know the house.
Andrew Mitchler is the guy. Yeah. And that house, I can't remember whether it's mass timber or whether it's just timber frame. I should have to check up. But that one, Do you remember the deep freeze they had in the States a few years ago where Texas froze, where Ted Cruz got in trouble for...
It was 24th of January going into February. It's the ice storm of Texas, 2021.
Yeah. It was... he went on holiday to Cancun.
I know it well.
Yeah. So that one... This passive house in Colorado had, I'd have to check the temperatures again. I knew it verbatim from my TED talk because it's the only way I could give it without doing my ums and ahs, you know. That job, there were a couple of artists living in the house during that deep freeze, and temperatures got ridiculously cold. And he had some sort of a strange system set up where the solar was preheating the air. I think he's solar assisted air heating or something in the house. Yeah. And the water pipes, the pipes froze. So he had no active heat input. And the temperature over a week or so dropped to, I think it dropped to sort of 14 or so degrees, something.
I've seen that data actually.
Yeah. So
Can I say, look, let's go just simply to common sense, right?
Yeah.
So you got,
that sends a shudder of fear.
I know.
In the UK.
In the extreme cold, like my mate, Anthony McDermott, runs a big practice in Oklahoma, and he's got this really sexy big house, and he's got two ground source heat pumps on it. So in the extreme cold, where do you get heat from, right? You burn stuff. So you burn logs, yeah? I'm talking about when the grid goes down. Or else you reach down into the earth and there's some heat down there. Mm-hmm. You try and harvest that. Trouble was that it was an extreme storm. So he had the two pumps on his two ground source heat pumps stop working because the shed blew over. So he's going to change the design of that. But you know, it's just common sense. Where do you get the heat from in the extreme cold? Like, if you're without electricity for 2 or 3 weeks, as happened in Northeast England, I think it was last year or year before, you've got to have heat, which is where you need your log burner.
Yeah.
I would always be wary about logs for a bunch of reasons, you know, burning biomass. I know what you're saying, but...
So we're talking about resilience, not common standard practice.
Yeah, I'm not even talking about the carbon of it. It's just the air quality. You know
what air quality? Where have you seen the stuff? Okay, so I'm on this that the air quality is fine. I mean, air quality. I had a carbon monoxide meter that went off over Christmas about 3 years ago in my house next to my cattle oven.
Yeah.
Which is like a ceramic urine.
Oh, yeah.
Stove. Yeah. Okay. And I thought, oh my God, it must be the cattle oven. It was the gas cooker. It's filling a quite large space with carbon monoxide. So I got rid of the gas cooker. But no, I mean, that's hyperbole. I mean, if push comes to shove in the extremes, you burn stuff, or maybe you go into the ground and your pump doesn't go off. But what, I mean, basically, we need bi-directional energy inverters so that when the grid goes down, you can still use your solar energy or your ground source heat pumping.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the idea of burning anything to stay warm in like, I've got a son who's got asthma, for instance, and when we had a, before we were living in the current place, we were in a renovated place nearby that had a stove, and you know,
it was probably damp.
I don't think so. I mean, and similarly, staying with his grandparents, when the stove is on, you know, he starts to cough. You know, it might be like
my. Well, I have a son with asthma too, and that's not the case with my cattle oven. Maybe it's there.
I think something interesting.
It's not just that; it's outdoor air quality too, though. When you've cumulative, when people are burning a lot of this stuff, you know, it's
As soon as the price of fuel went up and folk in Dublin started burning more fossil fuels in their homes, I remember Jeff anecdotally describing his son showing signs of suffering from the air quality, like within a week.
You're talking about, for instance, in Stockport in Manchester or something, you get a row of old terrace houses and they're burning their old rubbish from, you know, the
stuff like that.
I mean, that'd kill you.
I know. But I don't think it's controversial to say that the particulates that you get from burning biomass. You know who we have to have on, actually? Dr. Ben Jones from the University of Nottingham.
I know Ben.
He's fascinating.
Yeah, but what you have to do is also is show me the evidence. I mean, for instance, put up a monitor in my house with a high-efficiency cackle oven or ceramic stove like they used in Scandinavian houses. And that's very different from a metal stove. Mine's a high mass one where you burn it for a couple of hours and then it retains the heat.
Yeah.
It depends on the stove, on the house, on
the I know. Yeah.
It comes back to the same basic issue. It's got to be designed appropriately for resilience. I think we can happily sum it up in those two aspects. Right. Is there anything you'd like to say that you haven't had a chance to, Susan?
No, just thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, man, it's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Yeah.
And I would like to extend an open invitation. If you want to talk about any of these trips that you've been on, I'd love to speak to you about the Antarctic one when you come back, if you would like to do so. I'm not wanting to presume.
Well, maybe in the summer, because after I've been to the remote Pacific Island and the outback,
the three extremes.
Yeah. might be interesting. All of them.
Yeah, straight up. Yeah, that sounds excellent. All right, well, we'll do the goodbyes then now.
Nice to meet you, Jeff.
You Keep too.
Good one. Yeah,
long overdue, actually.
I think so, by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us at home. We'll say all the usual things. If you get something out of this, you probably know someone else who will as well. So please share the podcast with them. If you could review it would be greatly appreciated. 5 stars, because it's all the algorithm cares about. Buy, subscribe to Passive House Plus, advertise if you can. It is always appreciated. Join ACAN, join the AECB, join the IGBC. Ladies, check her own space. And Lloyd Alter's Substack. Well. Sorry, what?
The consultancy. We always nearly forget to mention the consultancy. Yeah.
Talk to us.
Yeah.
About work, not about work, whatever. We're interested. Lloyd's Substack, although I think he may be moving away from Substack soon because of all the Nazis that exist there. Oh, man, I feel like I'm forgetting something. Fuck it. Thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to speaking to you again.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Cheers. Bye. And thanks for joining us at home.
Thanks, William.
Bye. Bye.